of when all the dragons come back had plainly made him nervous.
I have to,
Cimmerine said, trying to sound noble and long-suffering.
The dragons will make sure I get safely back to Kazul's cave. And a month isn't too long to wait, after all.
I don't understand,
Thirindil said, and he did look thoroughly puzzled.
There's no point in you or anyone else coming up here to rescue me for at least a month, not till my ankle's better.
Oh, I see.
He tilted his head back and scanned the empty sky.
You're quite sure you'll be all right? Then I'll just be going before those dragons return.
He turned and started down the path as quickly as he could manage in full armor. 4. In which Kazul has a dinner party and Cimmerine makes dessert. Cimmerine watched Thirindil go with feelings of great relief. Now she had at least a month to find a permanent way of discouraging the knights, for she was quite certain that Thirindil would spread the news of her injury. She decided to put up her sign anyway, just in case, and after a little looking, she found a scrubby tree beside the path and hung the sign on it. On her way back to Kazul's cave, she noticed that the two pieces of the ledge were still invisible, and she was very careful about crossing them. She looked down once, out of curiosity, and was immediately sorry. She was not comfortable with the sight of her own feet, firmly planted on nothing at all, with the sharp, spiky tops of spruce trees in full view some 50 feet below. Kazul arrived only a few minutes after Cimmerine herself. Cimmerine was looking for some thread to mend her skirts, which had gotten torn and stained while she was climbing along the ledge, when she heard the unmistakable sounds of a dragon sliding into the main cave.
Cimmerine!
Coming!
Cimmerine called back. Abandoning her search, she picked up her lamp and hurried out to greet Kazul.
I'm glad to see you're still here,
Kazul said mildly, as Cimmerine came into the large cave.
Morance was quite sure you'd run off with a knight, or a wizard. I couldn't make out for certain which.
Is Morance the yellow-green dragon who wanted to eat me? Because if he is, he's just trying to make trouble.
I'm well aware of that,
Kazul said with a sigh that sent a burnt bread smell halfway across the cave.
But things would be easier for me if you didn't provide him with any material to make trouble with. Exactly what happened?
Well, Morwen came to visit this afternoon. We were talking about all the interruptions I've been having, and she suggested putting up a sign.
She explained why she had gone to put up the sign herself, and told Kazul in detail about her meetings with the wizard, the dragon, and the prince.
So, Morwen was here,
Kazul said. She sat back, and the scales on her tail rattled comfortably against the floor.
That simplifies matters. Did you bring the sign back with you?
No, I found a tree and hung it by the path,
Cimmerine said, wondering what this was all about.
In case Thirindil doesn't tell everyone about my ankle after all.
Better still,
Kazul said, and smiled fiercely, showing all her teeth.
Morance is going to regret meddling.
Meddling in what?
My business.
I'd like a little more of an explanation than that, if you don't mind giving one,
Cimmerine said with a touch of exasperation. Kazul looked startled, then thoughtful. Then she nodded.
I keep forgetting that you're not as empty-headed as most princesses. Sit down and make yourself comfortable. This may take a while.
Cimmerine found a rock and sat on it. Kazul settled into a more restful position, folded her wings neatly along her back, and began.
It has to do with status. Dragons aren't required to have princesses, you see. Most of us don't. There are never enough to go around. And some of us prefer not to have to deal with the annoyances that come with them.
Knights, Cimmerine guessed.
Among other things. So having a princess in residence has become a minor mark of high status among dragons.
A minor mark?
Kazul smiled.
I'm afraid so. It's the equivalent of, serving expensive imported fruit at dinner. It's a nice way of showing everyone how rich you are, but you could make just as big an impression by having some of those fancy pastries with the smooth glazed icing and spun sugar roses.
I see.
Cimmerine did see, though she found herself wishing that Kazul had found something else to compare it to. The talk of dinner reminded her too much of Moranza's repeated desire to eat her.
Lawrence is young and not very bright, I'm afraid,
Kazul said, almost as if she had read Cimmerine's mind.
He seems to have the mistaken impression that if a princess behaves badly, it reflects on the dragon who captured her. Possibly it comes from his inability to keep any of his own princesses for more than a week. Some of the lesser dragons were very snide about it when he lost his third one in a row. I believe she sneaked out while he was napping.
I don't see how he can blame his princesses. I mean, if most princesses are unwilling, it must be fairly usual for them to try to get away.
Of course, but Morantz doesn't see it that way. He's been trying to catch someone else's princess in a similar foolishness for years, and he's quite sure he's finally done so. He's undoubtedly spreading the story of your escape far and wide at this very minute.
Oh, dear.
Kazul smiled again, and her teeth glittered silver in the lamplight.
He'll look extremely foolish when it becomes obvious that you're still here, which is one reason I've asked a few of my friends to dinner tonight.
You've what?
All her worries about Morans were instantly replaced by worries about fixing dinner on short notice for an unknown number of dragons.
How many? What time will they be here? Where are we going to put them all?
6, around 8:30, in the banquet cave, and you won't be doing anything but dessert. I've already arranged for the rest of the meal.
Arranged? With whom?
Balamor the Giantess. She's loaned me the Cauldron of Plenty that she uses when her 12-headed son-in-law drops in for dinner unannounced. It'll handle most things, but all it can produce in the way of dessert is burned mint custard and sour cream and onion ice cream.
Ugh, I see a problem.
Exactly. Can you manage?
Not if you want Cherry's Jubilee. I haven't got a pot large enough to make 7 dragons worth of Cherry's Jubilee. Would chocolate mousse do? I can make 2 or 3 batches, and there should be time for all of them to chill if you're not starting until 8:30.
Chocolate mousse will be fine. Come along, and I'll show you where to bring it.
Cimmerine picked up a lamp and followed Kazul into the public tunnels that surrounded Kazul's private caves. She was a little surprised, but when she saw the size of the banquet cave, she understood. It was enormous. 50 or 60 dragons, perhaps even 100 of them, would fit into it quite comfortably. Obviously, it had to be a public room. There simply wasn't enough space under the Mountains of Mourning for every dragon to have a cave this size. Kazul made sure Cimmerine could find her way to the banquet cave without help, and then left her in the kitchen to melt slabs of chocolate and whip gallons of cream for the mousse. By the time she finished, she was hot and tired, and all she really wanted to do was take a nap. But Kazul was expecting her to serve the mousse, and Cimmerine wasn't about to appear before all those dragons in her old clothes with sweaty straggles of hair sticking to her neck and a smear of chocolate across her nose. So instead of napping, she pumped a cauldron of water, heated it on the kitchen fire, and took a bath. Once she was clean, she felt much better. She checked to make sure the mousse was setting properly, then went into her own rooms to decide what she should wear. Unfortunately, she was afraid she didn't have much choice. The wardrobe in her bedroom was full of neat, serviceable dresses suitable for cooking in or rummaging through treasure, but the only dressy clothes she had were the ones she had arrived in. She got them out of the back of the wardrobe and found, to her dismay, that the hem of the gown was badly stained with mud from her long walk. There was no time to clean it. She would have to wear one of the everyday dresses. With a sigh, Cimmerine turned back to the wardrobe and opened it once more to look for the nicest of the ordinary clothes. She gasped in surprise. The hangers were now full of the most beautiful gowns she had ever seen. Some were silk, and some were velvet. Some were heavy brocade, and some were layers of feather-light gauze. Some were embroidered with gold or silver, and some were sewn with jewels.
Well, of course,
Cimmerine said aloud after a stunned moment.
Why would a dragon have an ordinary wardrobe? Of course it's magic. What's in it depends on what I'm looking for.
One of the wardrobe doors waggled slightly, and its hinges creaked in smug agreement. Cimmerine blinked at it, then shook herself and began looking through the gowns. She chose one of red velvet, heavily embroidered with gold, and found matching slippers in the bottom of the obliging wardrobe. She let her black hair hang in loose waves nearly to her feet, and even dug her crown out of the back of the drawer where she'd stuffed it on her first night. She finished getting ready a few minutes early, Feeling very cheerful, she went to the kitchen to fetch the moose. It took Cimmerine 4 trips to get the moose down to the serving area just off the banquet cave. A dragon-sized serving was a little over a bucketful, and she could barely manage to carry 2 at a time. When everything was ready, she stood in the serving area and waited nervously for K'Zool to ring for dessert. She could hear the muffled booming of the dragons' voices through the heavy oak door, but she could not make out what any of them were saying. The bell rang at last, summoning Cimmerine to serve dessert. She carried the moose into the banquet cavern, 2 servings at a time, and set it in front of K'Zool and her guests. The dragons were crouched around a shoulder-high slab of white stone. Cimmerine had to be very careful about lifting the moose up onto it. Fortunately, she didn't have to wonder which dragon to serve first. She could tell which dragons were most important from their places at the table, and she made a silent apology to her protocol teacher, who had insisted that she learn about seating arrangements. Protocol had been one of the princess lessons Cimmerine had hated most. As she set the last serving in front of K'Zool, one of the other dragons said in a disgruntled and vaguely familiar voice,
"I see the rumors are wrong again, K'Zool. Or did you have to go after her and haul her back the way the rest of us do?"
Cimmerine turned angrily, but before she could say anything, a large gray-green dragon on the other side of the stone slab said,
"Nonsense, Warog. Girl's got more sense than that. You shouldn't listen to gossip. Next thing you know, you'll be chasing after that imaginary wizard Gowrim's been on about."
Cimmerine recognized the speaker at once. He was Roxham, the elderly dragon she had given 4 of her handkerchiefs to.
"I suppose it was that idiot Moranz again trying to cause trouble,"
a purple-green dragon said with bored distaste.
"Someone should do something about him."
"K'Zool still hasn't answered my question,"
Warog said, and his tail lashed once like the tail of an angry cat.
"And I'd like her to do so if the rest of you will stop sidetracking the conversation."
"Here now,"
Roxham said indignantly.
"That's a bit strong, Warog. Too strong, if you ask me."
"I didn't. I asked K'Zool, and I'm still waiting."
"I'm very pleased with my princess. And no, I didn't have to haul her back, as you would realize if you'd given the matter a little thought. Or does your princess normally leave 7 servings of chocolate mousse in the kitchen when she runs away?"
"Hear, hear!"
Cimmerine noted with interest that Warog's scales had turned an even brighter shade of green than normal, and that he was starting to smell faintly of brimstone.
"One of these days you'll go too far, K'Zool."
"You started it,"
K'Zool pointed out. She turned to the gray dragon.
"What's this about Gorum and a wizard, Roxham?"
"You haven't heard?"
Roxham said, sounding surprised.
"Gorum's been raving about it for weeks. Somebody snuck into her cave and stole a book from her library. No traces. But for some reason, she's positive it was a wizard."
Roxham sneezed, emitting a ball of flame that just missed hitting his bowl of mousse.
"Gives me an allergy attack just thinking about it."
"If it wasn't a wizard, who was it?"
the dragon at the far end of the table asked.
"Could have been anybody. An elf, a dwarf, even a human. No reason to think it was a wizard just because Gowrim didn't catch him in the act. Not with the amount of time she spends away from home."
"Which book did she lose?"
said the thin, brownish-green dragon next to K'Zool.
"What does it matter?"
the purple-green dragon muttered.
"Some history or other. And that's another thing. What would a wizard want with a history book? No, no. Gowrim's making a lot of fuss over a common thief. That's what I say."
"It could have been a wizard,"
said the dragon at the far end.
"Who knows why they want the things they want?"
"Ridiculous. A wizard wouldn't dare come through this part of the mountains. They know what we'd do to him, by George. Beg pardon,"
he added to the silver-green dragon next to him, who appeared to have been rather shocked by his language.
"I'm afraid you're wrong there. Cimmerine met one today, less than a 2-minute flight from my cave."
"What? What? You're sure?"
"That's done it."
The purple-green dragon rolled his head in an irritated gesture, so that his scales made a scratching noise as they rubbed together.
You'll never get him to quit talking about it now.
Quite sure,
Cimmerine assured Roxham, after glancing at Kazool to make sure she was expected to answer Roxham's question for herself.
He made two bits of the ledge I was standing on turn invisible so I would think it wasn't safe to keep going.
Certainly sounds like a wizard to me,
the dragon at the far end commented.
What did he look like?
Asked the silver-green dragon. Cimmerine described the wizard as well as she could, then added,
He said his name was Zeminar.
Zeminar? That's ridiculous.
Warog snorted.
Zeminar was elected head of the Society of Wizards last year. He wouldn't waste his time playing games with somebody's princess.
Not unless he had a great deal to gain by it,
the thin dragon said in a thoughtful tone. She turned her head and looked speculatively at Cimmerine.
Such as?
Warog said. He waited a moment, but no one answered.
No, I can't believe it was Zeminar. The girls made a mistake, that's all.
Perhaps it wasn't him,
Cimmerine said, holding on to her temper as hard as she could.
I've never met Zeminar, so I wouldn't know. But that's who he said he was.
And wouldn't it be amusing if she were right?
The purple-green dragon said, showing some interest in the proceedings for the first time.
I don't see that it matters,
the silver-green dragon said.
The important thing is that he was a wizard, poking around smack in the middle of our mountains. What are we going to do about it?
Tell King Tokars. His job to handle this sort of thing, isn't it?
What can Tokars do about it?
Warog said, and there was a faint undercurrent of contempt in his tone.
He could use the king's crystal to find out what the wizards are really doing,
the thin dragon said in a prim tone.
He won't use the crystal for anything less than a full-fledged war. And why should he? What could Tokars do even if he did find out some wizard was preying on poor defenseless dragons like Gwarim?
Lodge a formal protest with the Society of Wizards,
Roxham answered promptly, ignoring Warog's sarcasm.
Proper thing to do, no question. Then the next time anyone sees a wizard...
His voice trailed off, and he snapped his teeth together suggestively.
He'd probably just set up a committee,
the purple-green dragon said.
Can't anyone think of something else?
I don't think we should do anything until we have some idea what Zeminar was after,
said the thin dragon.
It could be important.
We have to do something,
the silver-green dragon said. Her claws clashed against the stone table.
We can't have wizards wandering in and out whenever they please. Why, we'd lose half our magic in no time.
Not to mention everyone sneezing themselves silly every time one of those dratted staves gets too close,
added the dragon at the far end. The dragons began arguing among themselves about what to do and how best to do it. It reminded Cimmerine of the way her father's ministers argued. Everyone seemed to agree that something ought to be done about the wizards, but they each had a different idea about what was appropriate. Roxham insisted huffily that the only thing to do was to inform the king, who would then make a formal protest. The thin dragon wanted to find out what the wizards were up to. She didn't say how this was to be done, before anyone tried to chase them off. The silver-green dragon wanted patrols sent out immediately to eat any wizard who ventured into the mountains of mourning. The dragon at the far end of the table wanted to attack the headquarters of the Society of Wizards the following morning, and the purple-green dragon thought it would be most entertaining to wait and see what the wizards did next. Warog was the only one of the guests who did not have a proposal, though he made occasional comments, usually sarcastic ones, about everyone else's suggestions. Kazool did not say anything at all. Cimmerine was at first surprised and then puzzled by her silence, since Kazool was the one who had set the whole discussion going to begin with. As the argument grew more heated, however, Cimmerine began to be glad that there was at least one dragon present who was not involved in it. The dragon at the far end of the table was starting to breathe little tongues of fire at the purple-green dragon, and Roxham was threatening loudly to have another allergy attack, but Cimmerine was fairly sure that Kazool would stop the discussion before things got completely out of hand. She was right. A moment later, while the dragon at the far end was taking a deep breath to continue arguing, and the Thin Dragon was winding up a long, involved train of logical reasons why her proposal was the best, Kazul said,
"Thank you all for your advice. I'll certainly think about it before I decide what to do."
"What do you mean by that?"
the Thin Dragon asked suspiciously.
"It was my princess who met the wizard. Therefore, it is my decision whether to report the matter to the king, or to take some action on my own, or to ask for cooperation from some of you."
None of the other dragons appeared to like hearing this, but to Simmerine's surprise, none of them gave Kazul any argument about it. The dragon at the far end of the table made a few half-hearted grumbles, but that was all, and the conversation turned to the intricacies of several draconian romances that were currently in progress. As soon as her guests appeared to have calmed down, Kazul gave the signal for the empty mousse dishes to be taken away, so Simmerine only heard a few incomprehensible snatches of the new conversation. She did not really mind. She had plenty to think about already. 5. In which Simmerine receives a formal call from her companions in dire captivity. Kazul slept late the following morning, and Simmerine was afraid that she would leave before Simmerine had a chance to ask about the dragon's after-dinner conversation. To her relief, Kazul called her in as soon as she was thoroughly awake and asked Simmerine to bring in the brushes for cleaning her scales.
"What was that crystal your friend mentioned last night?"
Simmerine asked as she laid out the brushes.
"The one she thought King Tokoz could use somehow to find out what the wizards are doing."
"The king's crystal? It's one of the magical objects that belongs to the King of the Dragons."
"But what does it do? And why did Warog think that King Tokoz wouldn't want to use it?"
"Using the crystal is difficult and tiring, and Tokoz is getting old. Zareth was right to say that the crystal ought to be used, but it will take more evidence than we have right now to persuade the king of that. As to what it does, the crystal shows things that are happening in other times and places. It's useful, but it can be very difficult to interpret correctly."
"Oh, a crystal ball,"
Simmerine said, nodding. She tapped Kazul's side, and the dragon bent her elbow so that the scales were easier to reach.
"The court wizard at Linderwall had one, but I had to stop my magic lessons before he got a chance to show me how to work it."
"The king's crystal is more like a plate, but the principle is the same."
"A crystal plate? No wonder nobody talks about it much. It just doesn't sound right."
Kazul shrugged.
"The king's crystal is much more accurate than an ordinary crystal ball. And if crystal plate sounds odd to most people, it means that fewer of them will try to steal it."
"Was that what the silver-green dragon meant when he said that if the wizard started wandering through the mountains, you'd lose half your magic in no time? I never heard that wizards stole magic rings and swords and things."
"Not magic things, magic. Wizards steal magic. That's where their power comes from."
"How can a wizard steal magic?"
Simmerine said skeptically. She climbed on a stool and began working at the ribs of Kazul's wings.
"Wizard staffs absorb magic from whatever happens to be nearby,"
Kazul said, stretching out her left wing so Simmerine could get at the base.
"That's why they're always hanging around places like the Mountains of Mourning and the Enchanted Forest. The more magic there is in the area, the more their staffs can soak up."
"What would happen if someone stole a wizard's staff? Would the wizard still be able to use it?"
"The wizard wouldn't be able to work any magic until he got it back. Most of them have a great many anti-theft spells on their staffs for exactly that reason. Of course, it happens anyway, now and then. And as long as the wizard and the staff are separated, the staff doesn't absorb magic."
"It doesn't sound like a very good arrangement to me. I can think of half a dozen ways a staff could be lost or forgotten or stolen or something. It doesn't seem sensible for a wizard to depend so much on anything that's so easy to mislay."
Kazul shrugged.
"They seem to like it."
"I can see why you don't want them in your part of the mountains."
"Can you? Do you have any idea how unpleasant it is to have part of your essence sucked out of you without so much as a by your leave? Not to mention the side effects."
Side effects? There. Turn around and I'll do your other side.
Roxham isn't the only dragon who's allergic to wizards.
Kazul said dryly as she shifted her position.
Or rather to their staffs. We all are. Roxham's just a little more sensitive than most. That's why we made the agreement with them in the first place.
The dragons have an agreement with the wizards?
Kazul nodded.
To be precise, the king of the dragons has an agreement with the head of the Society of Wizards. The wizards stay out of our portions of the Mountains of Mourning, and we allow them partial access to the Caves of Fire and Night. At least that's the way it's supposed to work. King Tokaz is getting old and forgetful, and lately wizards have been turning up in all sorts of places they aren't supposed to be.
Like that wizard Zeminar I met on the path. Do you think he really was the same Zeminar that's the head of the Society of Wizards?
I doubt that anyone, even another wizard, would dare impersonate him. He has a nasty reputation.
Cimmerine remembered the hard black eyes and sharp features of the wizard she had met. He had certainly looked nasty enough, even when he was pretending to be nice. He was sneaky, too, or he wouldn't have tried to trick her. And he had been very annoyed when Cimmerine got off the ledge without his help. Cimmerine frowned.
I wonder what he wanted, really. Do you suppose he'll stop by the way he said he would?
I almost wish he would try,
Kazul said. There was an angry glint in her eye, and her claws made a scratching sound against the stone floor of the cave as she flexed them.
Don't wiggle! If Zeminar is as tricky as everyone says, he won't come while you're here. He'll wait until you've gone somewhere and I'm alone.
True.
Kazul frowned. Then she looked at Cimmerine, and her eyes took on a speculative gleam.
He probably thinks you're as silly as most princesses, so he'll be hoping to trick you into giving him whatever it is he's after. And if he does...
Then maybe I can fool him instead. And once we know what he's after, we can decide what to do about it.
Kazul and Cimmerine discussed this idea while Cimmerine finished brushing the dragon's scales. There was very little they could do to prepare, since they did not know when Zeminar might show up at the cave, or what he might do when he arrived. Then Kazul went off to inspect the ledge where Cimmerine had met the wizard, to see whether bits of it were still invisible. When Kazul had gone, Cimmerine went into the library to hunt through all the books and scrolls of spells. The behavior of the dragons at dinner the previous evening had made a considerable impression on her, and she wanted to see whether she could find a spell to fireproof herself. Until then, she hadn't realized that when a dragon lost his temper, he started breathing fire. Not that she was planning to do anything to irritate Kazul, or any other dragon for that matter. But the dragons at dinner had been too annoyed to be careful, and she didn't want to get burned by accident, no matter how sorry the dragon might be afterward. At first, Cimmerine didn't have much luck. She hadn't had time to do much organizing in the library, and most of the books and scrolls were lying in haphazard, dust-covered piles. Some had even fallen onto the floor, and there were spiders everywhere. Cimmerine realized that if she wanted to find anything, she was going to have to do some more cleaning first. With a sigh, she went to get a bucket of water, some cloths for washing and dusting, and a handkerchief to tie over her hair. She worked for several hours, dusting books and manuscripts, wiping off the dirty bookshelves, and putting the books back in neat rows when the shelves were dry. She found two books and five old scrolls that looked as if they might be interesting. These she set on one of the tables to look at later. She had just pulled a stained and yellowed stack of papers out of the back of the second-to-last bookshelf when she heard someone hallooing outside.
Now what?
She muttered crossly. She set the papers on the table with the rest of the books she was planning to look at later and went out to see who was there. To her surprise, the noise was coming from the back entrance, not from the mouth of the cave. She hurried into the passage, rounded the corner, and found herself facing three beautiful, elegantly dressed princesses. They were all blonde and blue-eyed and slender, and several inches shorter than Cimmerine. The first one wore a gold crown set with diamonds, and her hair was the color of sun-ripened wheat. The second wore a silver crown set with sapphires, and her hair was the color of crystallized honey. The last wore a pearl-covered circlet, and her hair was the color of ripe apricots. They looked rather taken aback by the sight of Cimmerine in her dust-covered dress and kerchief. "Oh, bother," Cimmerine said under her breath. Then she smiled her best smile and said,
"Welcome to the caves of the dragon Kazool. May I help you with anything?"
"We have made the perilous journey through the tunnels to see the Princess Cimmerine, newly come to these caverns, to comfort her and together bemoan our sad and sorry fates,"
the first princess said haughtily.
"Tell her we are here."
"I'm Cimmerine. I don't need comforting, and I'm not particularly sad or sorry to be here. But if you'd like to come in and have some tea, you're welcome to."
The first two princesses looked as if they would have liked to be startled and appalled by this announcement, but were much too well-bred to show what they were feeling. The princess with the pearl circlet looked surprised and rather intrigued, and she glanced hopefully at her companions. They ignored her, but after a moment the first princess said grandly,
"Very well, we will join you then,"
and swept past Cimmerine into the cave. The other princesses followed, the one with the pearl circlet giving Cimmerine a shy smile as she passed. Cimmerine, wondering what she had gotten herself into, brought up the rear. The princesses stopped when they reached the main cave, and the ones in the gold and silver crowns looked a bit disgruntled. The one in the pearl circlet stared in unabashed amazement.
"My goodness," she said. "You certainly do have a lot of space."
"Eleonora,"
the gold-crowned princess said sharply, and the princess with the pearl circlet flushed and subsided, looking unhappy.
"This way,"
Cimmerine said hastily and led the three princesses into the kitchen.
"Do sit down,"
she said, waving at the bench beside the kitchen table. The gold-crowned princess looked at the bench with distaste, but after a moment she sat down. The other two followed her example. There was a brief silence while Cimmerine filled the copper tea kettle and hung it over the fire, and then the gold-crowned princess said,
"I am remiss in my duties, for I have not yet told you who we are. I am the Princess Caradwell of the Kingdom of Roxwell, now captive of the dread dragon Gornul. This,"
she nodded toward the princess in the silver crown,
"is the Princess Halana of the Kingdom of Porenbuth, now captive of the dread dragon Zareth. And this,"
she waved at the girl in the pearl circlet,
"is the Princess Eleonora of the Duchy of Tour-on-Marsh, now prisoner of the dread dragon Warog."
"Pleased to meet you. I am Princess Cimmerine of the Kingdom of Linderwall, now Princess of the Dragon Kazool. What sort of tea would you like? I have blackberry, ginger, chamomile, and gunpowder green. I'm afraid I used the last of the Lapsang Souchong this morning."
"Blackberry, please,"
Caradwell said. She gave Cimmerine a considering look.
"You seem to be most philosophic about your fate. Would that I had so valiant a spirit,"
Halana said in failing accents.
"But my sensibility is too great, I fear, for me to follow your example."
"If you don't like being a dragon's princess, why don't you escape?"
Cimmerine asked, remembering that Kazool had said that three princesses in a row had run away from the yellow-green dragon, Morans. Caradwell and Halana looked shocked.
"Without being rescued, walk all that way with dragons and trolls and goodness knows what else, hiding in the rocks, ready to eat me? Oh, I couldn't." "It isn't done. And I notice that you haven't tried it."
"But I'm enjoying being Kazool's princess. I suppose I might have been upset if I'd been carried off the way you were. But I can hardly complain as it is, can I?"
Eleonora leaned forward.
"Then you really did volunteer to be Kazool's princess?"
Caradwell and Halana turned and stared at their companion.
"Where did you get that ridiculous idea, Eleonora?"
Warog said...
"You must have misunderstood. No one volunteers to be a dragon's princess. It isn't done."
"Actually, Eleonora's quite right,"
Cimmerine said, as she set the teacups in front of her visitors.
"I did volunteer."
She smiled sweetly at the thunderstruck expressions on the faces of the first two princesses.
"I got tired of embroidery and etiquette.
Caradwell and Helena seemed unsure of how to take this announcement, so they made polite conversation about the tea and asked Simarine questions about the current fashions. Eleonora didn't say very much, and the few times she tried, either Caradwell or Helena jumped on her. Simarine felt rather sorry for Eleonora. The princesses swept off at last, still somewhat puzzled by Simarine's attitude. Simarine gave a sigh of relief and set about cleaning up the kitchen. She was just rinsing the last of the cups when she heard someone hesitantly clearing her throat behind her. Simarine turned and saw Eleonora standing timidly in the doorway.
"Hello again. Did you forget something?"
"Not exactly. I mean, I told Caradwell I did, but actually I just wanted to get away from them for a while. I hope you don't mind."
"I don't mind at all, as long as you don't expect more hospitality. I have to get back to work on the library."
"What are you doing?"
Eleonora asked. She seemed really interested, so Simarine explained about the fireproofing spell.
"It sounds like a wonderful idea,"
Eleanor said when Simarine finished.
"The dragons are careful around us, but it would be nice not to have to depend on them, not to lose their tempers. May I help?"
"I don't think Kazul would mind, but you'd better change clothes first. The library isn't very clean, I'm afraid."
Eleanor looked down at her silk gown, which was embroidered heavily with silver and pearls, and giggled. Simarine took her into the bedroom and found a plain, serviceable cleaning dress in the magic wardrobe. It took two tries before the wardrobe figured out that she wanted a dress for someone else, but once it caught on, it provided a splendid selection in Eleonora's size. Then they went to the library and got to work. Cleaning was much more enjoyable with Eleonora for company. By the time they finished dusting and straightening the last bookcases, the two girls were fast friends, and Eleonora was comfortable enough to ask Simarine straight out how it was that she had come to volunteer for a dragon.
"It's a long story,"
Simarine said, but Eleonora insisted on hearing it. So Simarine told her and then asked how Eleonora had happened to be carried off by Warog. To her surprise, Eleonora flushed.
"I think it was the only thing left that they could think of. My family, I mean."
"I don't understand."
"It's because I'm not a very satisfactory princess. I tried, I really did, but it started when the wicked fairy came to my christening."
"She put a curse on you?"
"No, she ate cake and ice cream until she nearly burst and danced with my Uncle Arthur until 2 in the morning and had a wonderful time. So she went home without cursing me, and Aunt Ermintrude says that that's where the whole problem started."
"Lots of princesses don't have christening curses."
"Not if a wicked fairy comes to the christening. And that was only the beginning. When I turned 16, Aunt Ermintrude sent me a gold spinning wheel for my birthday, and I sat down and spun. I didn't prick my finger or anything."
Simarine was beginning to see what Eleonora was getting at.
"Well, if you didn't have a christening curse..."
"So Aunt Ermintrude told Mama to put me and a spinning wheel in a room full of straw and have me spin it into gold. And I tried, but all I could manage was linen thread. And who ever heard of a princess who can spin straw into linen thread?"
"It's a little unusual, certainly."
"Then they gave me a loaf of bread and told me to walk through the forest and give some to anyone who asked. I did exactly what they told me. And the second beggar woman was a fairy in disguise. But instead of saying that whenever I spoke, diamonds and roses would drop from my mouth, she said that since I was so kind, I would never have any problems with my teeth."
"Really? Did it work?"
"Well, I haven't had a toothache since I met her."
"I'd much rather have good teeth than have diamonds and roses drop out of my mouth whenever I said something. Think how uncomfortable it would be if you accidentally talked in your sleep. You'd wake up rolling around on thorns and rocks."
"That never occurred to me."
"Was that everything?"
"No. Aunt Ermintrude persuaded one of her fairy friends to give me a gown and a pair of glass slippers to go to a ball in the next kingdom over. And I broke one before I even got out of the castle."
"That's not so surprising. Glass slippers are for deserving merchants' daughters, not for princesses."
"Try telling Aunt Ermintrude that. I think she was the one who found out that Warog was going to ravage a village just over the border and arranged for me to go and visit on the right day so I could be carried off. She didn't even warn me. I suppose she thought that if I knew, I'd mess it up somehow."
"I don't think I would get along very well with your Aunt Ermintrude."
Oh, it wasn't so bad. At least at first. Warog ignored me most of the time, especially after he found out I can't cook. And it was a real relief not to have Aunt Ermintrude around anymore. Only then Gornul brought Caradwell and Xerath brought Halana and...
And they've been making life miserable for you ever since. Why don't you stand up to them?
I tried, but you don't know what they're like. Caradwell goes on and on about correct behavior, and Halana dissolves in tears as soon as it looks like she's losing an argument, and they've both had dozens of knights and princes try to rescue them. I've only had two.
How do you do it? I've had 9 already, and they're a dreadful nuisance. Eleonora stared at Cimmerine, then began to giggle. What's so funny?
Caradwell bragged for a week because 2 knights and a prince tried to rescue her the first month she was here. She said it was some kind of record. You've barely been with Kazul for 4 weeks, and you've had 9? And you didn't even mention it when Caradwell was here? She's going to be furious when she finds out.
If she wants them, she can have them, Cimmerine said. Her expression grew thoughtful. Maybe they'd be easier to get rid of if I sent them along to another princess instead of just trying to get them to go home.
Oh!
said Eleonora, and went off into gales of laughter again. Cimmerine gave her a questioning look.
It's the idea of Caradwell being... Oh, my being rescued by a second-hand knight. Oh, dear.
Cimmerine's eyes began to dance. I could take a good look at them first to make sure they're worthy of her before I sent them on, she suggested. This was too much for either of them, and they both collapsed in laughter.
You wouldn't really, would you?
Eleonora said when she began to recover. Send the knights to rescue someone else? I certainly would. I meant it when I said they were a nuisance. I wouldn't want to upset Caradwell, though. I'll have to think about the best way of handling it. It's a good thing there probably won't be any more of them for a few weeks. I should have plenty of time to figure something out.
How do you know that?
Eleonora asked. Cimmerine explained about the sign, and Therindel and her sprained ankle. Eleonora was impressed and promised to help if she could.
I'll tell Halana that you've twisted your ankle. I know she'll tell the next knight who comes to rescue her, and then it won't matter if your Prince Therindel doesn't tell anybody.
This settled, the 2 girls sat down and began looking through the books and scrolls Cimmerine had piled on the table. Eleonora, having been brought up as a proper princess despite the tiny size of her country, did not read Latin, so Cimmerine had to examine those scrolls herself. There was a sizable stack of books left, however, and Eleonora waded into them with a will. It was Cimmerine, however, who finally found the spell they were searching for. I think this is it, she said, looking up from an ancient, crumpled scroll. Being a spell for the resisting of heat and flames of all kinds, in particular those which are the product of magical beasts, she read. Yes, there's a list, and it includes dragons.
I would think dragons would be at the top. Is it difficult?
It doesn't look hard, Cimmerine said, studying the page. Some of the ingredients are pretty rare, but it says you only need them for the initial casting. After that, you can reactivate the spell just by throwing a pinch of dried feverfew in the air and reciting a couplet.
That's not bad,
Eleonora said. She came around the table and peered over Cimmerine's shoulder at the faded ink.
Is it Latin?
No, it's just an ornate style of writing, Cimmerine assured her. It's not hard to read once you get the hang of it. See, there's the couplet. Power of water, wind, and earth. Turn the fire back to its birth. It's a variation on a dragon spell.
How do you know that?
The court wizard at home mentioned it when he was teaching me magic, Cimmerine replied, studying the directions.
Then maybe it really will work on dragon fire. Can we get all the ingredients for the initial casting?
I think so, but it'll take a while. I don't have any wolfsbane, and I'm not at all sure about unicorn water. Come on, let's check and see what we need to get. They took the scroll into the kitchen and began hunting through the shelves and supplies. They found more of the ingredients than Cimmerine had expected, and she began to wonder whether one of Kazul's previous princesses might have studied magic. They did not, however, find any wolfsbane or unicorn water, nor were they able to locate any white eagle feathers. Eleonora discovered a very cobwebby jar labeled powdered hen's teeth, but it was quite empty. Cimmerine made a list of the ingredients they still needed, while Eleonora changed back into her pearl-embroidered dress.
Eleonora took a copy of the list and went back to her quarters, much excited, to see whether she happened to have anything useful in the dusty, disused corners of her dragon's kitchen. Cimmerine doubted that she would find anything, but there was no harm in letting her look. As soon as Eleonora left, Cimmerine tidied up the kitchen and put all but two of the books back on the shelves in the library. One was the scroll of spells, in which she had found the fireproofing spell, because she wanted to take a more careful look at some of the other charms and enchantments it described. The other book was a fat volume, bound in worn leather, with the words Historia Dracorum in cracked and flaking gold leaf on the cover. Cimmerine had decided it was time she really got to work on her Latin. 6. In which the wizards do some snooping, and Cimmerine snoops back. For the next 3 weeks, Cimmerine spent most of her free time studying the fireproofing spell and collecting the ingredients she would need to cast it. A few, like the wolf's bane and feverfew, she could gather herself from the herbs that grew on the slopes of the mountains. Eleonora found a little jar of hippopotamus oil among the cosmetics left by her predecessor, the unicorn water Cimmerine got from Morwen, after promising her a copy of the spell if it worked. She went to Kazul about the white eagle feathers, though she was a little afraid to explain what she wanted them for. She didn't want Kazul to think that she was worried about Kazul losing her temper and accidentally roasting her. Fortunately, the dragon found the whole idea very interesting.
"It could be very useful,"
Kazul said reflectively.
"There are enough hot-tempered youngsters around that it would be well worth fireproofing the princesses who have to deal with them."
"I'm not sure I'll be able to fireproof anyone at all. I still need the white eagle feathers and the powdered hen's teeth, and nobody seems to have any."
"I'll see what I can do,"
Kazul said, and a few days later she dropped a bundle of white feathers at the door of the kitchen. Half a feather was stuck to one of her right claws, and another was caught between two of her teeth, and she looked very pleased with herself. Cimmerine decided not to ask any awkward questions. Even Kazul, however, could not find any hen's teeth, so Cimmerine had to keep putting off trying out the spell. When she wasn't working on collecting the ingredients for the fireproofing spell, Cimmerine read the Historia Dracorum. It was very difficult at first. After all, it had been a long time since her last Latin lesson. She kept working at it until she started to remember the right endings for the declensions and conjugations and cases. Shortly after that, she realized that she was not having to look up quite as many words as she had at the beginning. From then on, her progress was rapid. It helped that she found the book fascinating. Dragon history was not a subject commonly taught to princesses in Linderwall, but as she was now a dragon's princess, she had personal reasons to be interested. Besides, the history of the dragons was very exciting. Every page was full of descriptions of dragons ravaging villages, carrying off princesses, defeating knights and princes, and occasionally being defeated by them, and fighting with wizards, giants, and each other. When the book wasn't describing battles, it was describing famous dragons' hordes and peculiar draconian customs. Cimmerine was in the library with the Historia Dracorum in front of her and her Latin dictionary on the table beside her left hand when she heard someone calling from the front of the cave. She had hoped it would be at least a little longer before the knights started coming back, so she couldn't help sighing as she stuck a leather bookmark in the book and closed it. Then she went out to argue with whoever it was until they went away. Two wizards were standing just outside the mouth of the cave. Cimmerine saw their wooden staves first, before she was close enough to see their faces. As she came nearer, she recognized the one on the left as Zeminar. The one on the right was taller and younger. His brown hair and beard showed no trace of gray. His blue and brown robes were identical to the older wizard's, except for the colors. His eyes were the same bright black as his companion's, and he looked at Cimmerine in a way that made her feel uneasy.
"Good morning to you, Princess Cimmerine,"
Zeminar said.
"I thought I would take you up on your kind invitation to visit. I hope we haven't come at an inconvenient time."
"Not at all,"
Cimmerine said, thinking hard. She had promised Kazul that she would try to find out what Zeminar was after if he showed up, and here he was. Maybe if she convinced him that she was as silly as her sisters, he would be careless enough to let something slip.
I thought perhaps we might have, since it took you so long to come out.
Zeminar said mildly, but Simring thought there was a hint of suspicion in his eyes.
I must not have heard you right away,
Simarine said, batting her eyes innocently, the way her next youngest sister did whenever she had done something particularly foolish.
Kazul has quite a large set of caves, and I was in one of the ones at the back. I'm so sorry.
Zeminar stroked his beard with his left hand.
That would make it difficult for you. Perhaps we could set up a spell for you. One that would let you know whenever anyone comes to visit. It would be more pleasant for visitors, too, if they didn't have to shout. What do you think, Antorel?
Like the one at the headquarters of the Society,
the second wizard said, nodding.
We could do it in 2 or 3 minutes right from here. It'd be easy.
Zeminar shot a dark look at his companion. Simarine was sure that he'd wanted to pretend he was inventing a difficult new spell so that he would have an excuse to wander around Kazul's caves.
Quite so. Well, princess?
Oh, dear, I don't know,
Simarine said, doing her best to imitate the way her eldest sister behaved whenever anyone wanted her to decide anything.
It sounds very nice, but Kazul is so picky about where things go and how things are done. No, I couldn't. I simply couldn't let you do anything like that without asking Kazul first.
What a pity,
Zeminar said. His companion coughed and shuffled his feet.
Ah, yes. Allow me to present my son, Antorel. I hope you don't mind my bringing him along.
Of course not.
I am pleased to make the acquaintance of such a lovely princess,
Antorel said, bowing. Simarine blinked. This wasn't getting anywhere. Maybe if she brought them inside, they'd relax a little.
Thank you,
she said to Antorel.
Won't you come in and have some tea?
We would be delighted if you'll lead the way, princess.
This way,
Simarine said. She stopped just inside the mouth of the cave and gave the wizards her sweetest and most innocent smile.
You can leave your staves right here. Just lean them up against the wall.
Antorel looked considerably startled, and Zeminar frowned.
Is this, too, something your dragon requires?
I don't know,
Simarine said, wrinkling up her forehead the way her third from eldest sister did whenever she was puzzled, which was often.
But they'll be so awkward in the kitchen, don't you think so? There's not very much room.
We'll manage.
Simarine hadn't really expected to get the wizards to let go of their staffs, but it had been worth a try. She shrugged and smiled, and led them on into the kitchen, where she made a point of bumping into the staffs or tripping over them every time she went by. Finally, Antorel turned his sideways and stuck it under the table. Zeminar hung onto his with a kind of grim, suspicious stubbornness that made Simarine wonder whether she was fooling him at all with her pretended silliness. The wizards made uncomfortable conversation about the weather and the size of the kitchen for several minutes while Simarine fixed the tea and poured it.
Are the rest of Kazul's caves this large?
Zeminar asked, as Simarine handed him his teacup. She had given him the one with the broken handle, even though he was a guest, because she didn't trust him.
Oh, yes.
She was beginning to think she was never going to find out anything. The two wizards seemed perfectly happy to sit at the kitchen table and talk about nothing whatever for hours.
Remarkable. You know, we wizards don't often get to see the inside of a dragon's cave.
I'll bet you don't, thought Simarine as she gave him a puzzled smile. That's too bad, she said aloud.
Yes, it is. Perhaps you'd be willing to show us around?
Simarine thought very rapidly. It was obvious that she wasn't going to learn anything if the wizards just sat at the kitchen table and drank tea, so she decided to take a chance.
Well, I suppose it would be all right as long as I don't take you into the treasure rooms.
That's fine,
Antorel said, a little too quickly.
You won't touch anything, will you?
Simarine said as they stood up.
Kazul is so particular about where things are kept.
Of course not,
Zeminar said, smiling insincerely. Simarine smiled back and led the way out into the hall. She watched the wizards carefully as she took them through the large main cave, the general storage caverns, and the big cavern where K'Zul visited with other dragons. Zeminar made polite noises about the size and comfort of everything, but neither he nor Antarel seemed very interested.
"And this is the library,"
Simarine said, throwing the door open.
"I am impressed,"
Zeminar said, and Simarine could tell that this time he meant it. She stepped sideways, so that she could keep an eye on both of the wizards at the same time.
"A remarkable collection,"
Antarel commented. He began walking around the room, admiring the bookshelves and scanning the titles of the books.
"What's this?"
Zeminar said, bending over the table.
"The Historia Dracorum? A surprising choice for light reading, princess."
His eyes met Simarine's, and they were hard and bright and suspicious.
"Oh, I'm not reading it,"
Simarine said hastily, opening her eyes very wide.
"I just thought it would make the library look nicer to have a book or two sitting out on the table. More lived in."
Zeminar nodded, looking relieved and faintly contemptuous.
"I think it works very well, princess. Very well indeed."
Then he looked over at the other side of the room and said sharply,
"Antarel, what are you doing?"
Simarine turned her head in time to see Antarel put out a hand and deliberately tip several books off one of the shelves.
"Stop that,"
she said, forgetting to sound silly.
"I'm very sorry, princess. Will you help me put them back where they belong?"
Simarine had no choice but to go over and help him. It took several minutes to get everything back in place because Antarel kept dropping things. Simarine got quite annoyed with him and finally did it all herself. As she started to turn back to the center of the room, she caught a glimpse of Zeminar hastily closing the Historia Dracorum. Simarine pretended not to notice, but she made a mental note that he had been looking at something near the middle of the book.
"That was dreadfully careless of you,"
Simarine said, frowning at Antarel.
"Very clumsy,"
Zeminar agreed.
"I don't know what K'Zul will say when she finds out about it. Really, it is too bad of you. I did ask you not to touch anything, you know."
"Yes, you did. And I wouldn't like to think that we had gotten you in trouble. Perhaps it would be best if you didn't mention to K'Zul that we were here at all."
"I suppose I could do that."
"Of course you can. And I'll come back in a few days to make sure everything's all right."
"I think it's time we were on our way,"
Zeminar said, giving his son a dark look.
"Thank you for showing us around, princess."
Simarine escorted them out of the cave and made sure they had left, then hurried back to the library. She spent the next several hours poring over the middle parts of the Historia Dracorum, trying to figure out what Zeminar had been looking at. She was still there when K'Zul arrived home and called for her.
"That wizard Zeminar finally came, and he brought his son along with him,"
Simarine said as she came out of the library.
"I know,"
said K'Zul. Her voice sounded a little thick, as if she had a cold.
"I could smell them the minute I came in."
"Is that why you sound so odd? You're not going to sneeze, are you?"
I don't think so. Don't worry about it. I'll have plenty of time to turn my head away."
"I wish I could get hold of some hen's teeth. That fireproofing spell."
"Have you looked in the treasure rooms?"
"No,"
Simarine replied, startled. She remembered seeing a number of jars and bottles of various shapes and sizes when she had been organizing the treasure, and none of them had been labeled.
"I didn't think of it. And besides, it's your treasure."
"You're my princess, at least until someone rescues you or I decide otherwise,"
K'Zul pointed out.
"Go ahead and look. And if you find any hen's teeth, use them. Be careful when you're checking the jars, though. There are one or two with lead stoppers that shouldn't be opened."
"Lead stoppers. I'll remember."
"Good. Now, what did those wizards want?"
"I'm not sure."
Simarine explained everything that had happened, including how she had seen Zeminar closing the history book as she turned, and how the two wizards had been perfectly willing to leave right after that.
"But just before they disappeared, Antarel said he might come back another time. So I don't know whether they found what they were looking for or not."
"Do you know which part of the Historia Dracorum Zeminar was reading?"
Somewhere in the middle, a little past my bookmark. I was just looking at it when you came in. It's the part about how the dragons came to the mountains of mourning and settled into the caves and chose a king.
That's the section where the Historia describes the caves of fire and night,